This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
Alrighty, welcome to episode 4 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have Ryan Rucco as our guest. Ryan, who you might hear calling NBA games on ESPN, Nets games on YES, Yankee games on YES, Yankee games on WFAN. He hosts the R2C2 podcast with CC Sabathia, and he's the voice of the WNBA. And as much as that schedule might seem a little daunting, he makes it all sound pretty effortless, which is really impressive. Ryan, welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Did you always want to be a multi-sport play-by-play voice, or did you grow up with one job in mind?
You know, first of all, thank you for having me, Brandon. I never thought about multi-sports. I just thought about doing the gig. Like, if you would have asked me when I was first thinking of what I wanted to do career-wise in life, and I knew that playing second base for the Yankees was no longer going to be an option, yeah, I would have said, and you can even see in my fifth grade yearbook, to announce for the Yankees. Since I was 10 years old, I knew I wanted to be, or even 9 years old, I knew I wanted to be a pro sports announcer, and the Yankees would have been the ultimate gig. But then when I got to college and I actually started doing demos, I just loved calling basketball. I loved the rhythm of it. I really enjoyed calling football as well, but basketball just really struck me. And so at that point, I actually, in college, I was like, you know, if I could only just call one sport, I definitely want it to be basketball. And then things just sort of naturally evolved, where earlier in my career, I was calling mostly basketball and football. YES started asking me to do some Yankee stuff. And then the football didn't really make sense with how much basketball I was doing. So the football kind of dropped away, and then it became basketball and baseball. And that's where we're at now. But that was sort of the vision and the natural evolution of just how things ended up breaking down.
When you took over as the voice of the WNBA in 2013, I think that was,
yep,
you were already doing NBA games at that point. Did you look at the WNBA as a stepping stone? Did you anticipate that you would potentially hold on to it for over a decade now?
No, I never thought I would be doing it as long as I am, because I was naive to the gem of a project it is to work on from a broadcasting standpoint.
Yeah.
And I was naive to how wonderful the league is and how incredible the basketball is. When I was first asked about it, I've been honest about this, I kind of was like, okay, that's cool, but I'm already doing NBA. Like, why is this such a great gig for me?
Right.
And there were people inside ESPN, I give credit to Lori Orlando and Tim McCarthy, who were really like, trust us, you're going to love this. You're going to love working with Rebecca Lobo, and this league is awesome to work on. And they were 100% right. And it did not take me long to appreciate how awesome the basketball was, how incredible it is to work with Rebecca and Holly, which it's just working with them is one of my favorite things in life, never mind in work. And then how much I enjoy being a part of this growing league. You know, I love feeling like we're all on the same team. We're all invested in this property and this project and this league. And we all truly believe that it has, you know, an atmospheric rise still to go with, yeah, all the growth that's happened already. And so I don't know, you know, I never in the moment look at any gig or job as a stepping stone, because I think you don't do the best work if you look at it that way, right? Like, you have to fully immerse yourself and be insistent upon crushing whatever it is that's in front of you. I had that mentality when I was an intern at YES transcribing tape, and I've tried to have that mentality with every gig I've ever done on air in my career. But if you would have asked me that question of like, oh, do you think you're going to do it for 10 years? I would have said, no, I don't think so.
Right.
Whereas now, when people say like, oh, do you think you'll do it forever? I'm like, maybe, because I love the league. And, you know, if I'm fortunate enough to be in that position and the league continue to want me to do it, and and ESPN does as well, and they keep the rights, then maybe, because I really, really love getting to be the soundtrack to big moments for these amazing women and play a role, hopefully, in growing this league.
How is the WNBA perceived from your perspective? Like, do you think it gets unfairly judged because it's compared to the NBA as opposed to being looked at as its own sport and a league that really is still pretty young?
Yeah, I think that the perception has changed a lot in the 10 years that I've been doing this. I definitely sense I sense a very different perception about the league compared to when I started. Just people understanding the value of it, understanding the way these women have such powerful voices, such beautiful hearts, and a willingness to continue to show both of them in public. And if you think about it, if you're talking about a brand, and I think more and more businesses are understanding this as well, and who you'd want representing your brand, I don't know that there are many better choices out there than the women of the WNBA. And I think that more and more across our country, people have started to realize that and appreciate that. And so instead of, you know, before, people used to love to use the WNBA as a punchline, as a joke. I think now people understand the value, first and foremost, of the basketball, and then also of these women and how incredible they are, just as these leaders in our society. So I feel like the perception is a lot different, but those comparisons to the NBA do still come up a lot. And Brandon, I agree with your premise that they are unfair. This is something Sue Bird talks about a lot, who's a close friend of mine, how much differently things would be framed when evaluating the WNBA if you weren't comping it to the NBA. And it really isn't a fair comp, or even it's not even a relevant one, really, when you're talking about businesses and leagues. And so I do think that sometimes that sort of unfairly shapes the way people view the WNBA and its success, because they just look at, oh, and that's the basketball league where the men play, and this is what's happening over there. And it's like, well, no, that's not really the comp for whether or not this is a successful business right now.
Has that narrative started to change in the last 10 years since you've been part of the WNBA? Have you witnessed that change already?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's changed at least, you know, look, if someone has no interest or understanding or awareness really of the WNBA, then I'm sure that's still the primary thought in their mind. But for people who are, you know, a little bit more on the inside or who are a little bit more tuned into sports, I think that started to break away a little bit. So it, you know, we're not all the way there, but I do think people have started to understand that just taking whatever's happening in the WNBA and comparing it to the NBA is sort of an ignorant comparison and just not relevant. So I think we've started to get to that place.
I rattled off some of your jobs, and obviously you have a very busy schedule. It could be draining at times, I'm sure. Did you hear Michael Kay ask Sarah Kustaka and Jeff Van Gundy about your voice exercises last month?
I heard Jeff's response, which was hilarious. And I didn't hear Sarah's, but I had been told about it when it was happening. Yeah.
Yeah, Sarah was pretty nice about it. Jeff had said the first time he heard you start doing your tongue trills that he wanted to choke you.
Yeah, Jeff's my guy. I love Jeff. He is, me and him are we have a wonderful relationship, and he's awesome in that. Like, I remember there was one time we were having, I think it was, this might have been last year, we were having like a production meeting with him and Mark. I was doing a game with him and Mark Jackson in Phoenix, and it was one of the first times that we were back in person for production meetings after COVID and everything. Yeah. And I think I was asking for like hot water at breakfast. And then maybe I even did a little vocal warm up myself, or I had something with honey. There was a myriad of things happening for my voice. And then something else funny that came up And I don't know if we're allowed to curse on this podcast.
Yeah, okay.
Because I'll directly quote Jeff. But he just like turned, he looked at me and he goes, you know, you got a lot of weird shit to you, but I dig it. That's the kind of like, I feel like relationship we have. And just what makes Jeff awesome is Jeff is hilarious with observational humor, and he just knows how to point something out to anybody and just make it funny. He really reminds me of a character in Curb or in Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And like the way he is on air is the way he is in real life. And I think it's, you know, part of what makes him so excellent on air. But that time he was talking about my vocal exercises, I can remember we were driving back from Dayton. And I think it was actually like, I think we had done a couple NBA games together maybe before that. But this was one of the first times we were getting any sort of like hang time.
Yeah.
It was like a crossover game. And we were doing a college game in Dayton together. And we were driving to the airport right after. And I was like, do you mind if I do this afterwards? And he was like, waiting a second. He was like, what are you doing? Like, this is so strange. Meanwhile, Sarah takes a slightly more loving approach to my idiosyncrasies.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I commend you for meeting Jeff Van Gundy and early on in your relationship being shameless enough to start doing tongue trills and giving yourself a throat massage. Like, most people might be a little nervous, embarrassed to break that out early on, but you had to do it and you went for it.
Hey, I kind of feel like that's part of what makes me be able to do my job on air. Yeah. And if I perform, then they're going to respect me. So I might as well do the things that are going to help me perform.
And Jeff Van Gundy, who, when I was growing up, like I just assumed he didn't even have a voice because he looked and sounded so physically ill so often during pretty much every interview and press conference he did when he was the coach of the Knicks. So like maybe some tea and tongue trills would have been helpful. Have you tried to get him to do some of those voice exercises?
Well, you know, I don't know that I've really pushed hard on that with Jeff, but I will say I always think that NBA head coaches could use a lot of different vocal guidance and therapy. I mean, we've seen Michael Malone in these playoffs and the way he's lost his voice. We've heard, you know, the way Doc's voice is sort of like always permanently, a little affected. There's the other funny thing I do, which I've had some people in the business latch onto as well, is there's a woman named Christine Schneider, who runs something called Life Light Massage, and she specializes in laryngeal therapy. And so she does actual like manual laryngeal therapy massage to try and loosen up the accessory muscles to help your larynx be able to work at its best so that you can get the full sound in your voice. So I've often thought that NBA coaches, when they come through New York, they should just make it a point to stop and see Christine, because they all need it, the way they use their voices, the way they're constantly screaming. And then they should be drinking hot water and having Manuka honey and constantly sucking on lozenges as they're talking. And they should have Entertainer's Secret, the little voice spray. But I don't know if they do any of that. I really think they should, though.
Have you had voice issues before, or is all of this just precautionary?
So when I was first starting out in the business, I was hosting a 5 a.m. radio show on ESPN New York with Robin Lumberg called The Leadoff Spot. And I had gotten sick. And I also at that time was hosting Yankee Stadium Scoreboard. I was the in-house host for the Yankees. So I would do pregame, postgame stuff. And basically the way I would sleep during that time is, because I had to get up at 3 a.m. for my show, is on a typical day where I was working Yankees on my show, I would get up at 3 a.m, go do my show. And then I was doing updates, local updates for Mike and Mike. So I was at the studio till like 9 or 10. Then I'd come home. I'd nap for like 3 hours, go to the stadium. And then eventually I get back and probably sleep from like midnight to 3. So I was kind of sleeping in 2-3 hour stints. like a 3 hour nap in like early after late morning, early afternoon, and like 3 hours of sleep at night. And so I was just drained, exhausted. And I was using my voice constantly because of the live hosting stuff, which live hosting is probably the most taxing thing on your voice. And then, cause you don't have the same kind of support in your headphones to make you not push as hard. Plus sometimes you're working over a live audience. And then I also was doing the show. And so anyway, I ended up like, I was like, damn, my voice is like kind of gone. And I got connected through Elliot Pellman, who was former Jets doctor and a friend of my family, got connected to this man named Max April, who's maybe the best pediatric ENT in the country. And he also, he's very familiar with voices and he takes care of a lot of people in the businesses, vocal cords and stuff. So I got connected with him and he ended up introducing me to a lot of different people. And I kind of built out this team where I now have all this preventative stuff. So at the time I had like scopes done and my voice was just sore. I had acid reflux and I had like, inflamed vocal cords, but nothing that would need surgical addressing or whatever. And from that moment forward, I just kind of committed myself to doing whatever I could to prevent vocal issues. And I know like when my voice is really tired and it needs a rest, what kind of things I can do to maintenance it. So just trying to be preventative as much as I possibly could. I could nerd out on this stuff all day, but I'm trying to give you as brief a synopsis as I can, although I know that wasn't especially brief.
And Michael K actually had throat surgery a few years ago. So like you'd think he'd be a little bit more supportive of taking care of your voice in that manner.
Well, and in the beginning, I mean, and it was Dr. April who I'd introduced Michael to, who ended up helping him get on the path to recovery there. And he eventually then saw Dr. Zeitel, who's done Dick Vitale's vocal surgeries and Adele's and is the best at doing the actual procedures in the world. And but Michael was doing these extensive warm-ups for a while in the aftermath, and then I think he let them go at some point.
Okay.
Yeah.
How has Michael K been for your career? Both Fordham grads, you've worked at ESPN Radio in New York. You work at Yes. You fill in for him on Yankee games. A lot of parallels there.
Yeah, he's been amazing for my career. Absolutely amazing. I think there are so many ways in which he's positively influenced me in my career. One of the biggest ways that Michael has positively influenced my career is the way he co-signed me when I was young. Michael would tell everybody who would listen when I was 21 years old, this guy is amazing. You have to hear this guy. He's the next big thing in play-by-play. He's awesome. And, when someone hears you at 21, they may think you have ability, but there's always going to be some sort of hesitation because of the lack of experience. But when you get a cosign like Michael was giving me with the fervor that he was, it makes people listen even closer. And I think that there was a legitimacy that Michael gave me by co-signing me like that, that helped get me amazing opportunities early in my career and helped a perception of my ability to broadcast as well. And so I am forever grateful. And he's continued to be an amazing advocate and ally and friend and mentor for me throughout the years in a variety of different ways. And, just a quick story on how that beginning part, one of the ways it manifested in a specific example was the Dodgers were looking for a TV announcer to do the games that Vince Scully wasn't doing any longer. Right. This was like in, I want to say this was like in 2009. So I think it's 2009. So I graduated college in 2008, was 21. Michael, my agent had connected with the Dodgers, like, look, you should really take a look at Ryan, whatever. And Michael called up the Dodgers and was like, you absolutely positively should hire this guy. It will be a huge mistake if you don't. Like, went on and on and on about it. And I ended up getting into, I don't know if it was the final round of interviews, but it was like a very small group of people who got to the round of interviews that I did. And they told me maybe the biggest reason why was because of the way Michael spoke about me. Mm. because they made that kind of impression. I didn't obviously end up getting that gig, and it wasn't Joe Davis at the time; it was someone else before Joe. But that gives you an idea of the way Michael went to bat for me, I'm forever grateful to Michael.
Yeah, that'd be quite the job to get right out of college, yeah, or a year removed from college.
Yeah.
So you fill in for Kay on Yes. You've also filled in for John Sterling on WFAN. Do you have a preference calling radio or TV, baseball, play-by-play on either one?
You know, there is something nostalgic and beautiful about calling it on radio.
Yeah.
Where it's so fun. It is just so fun. And so and I loved working with Susan, loved that experience. So there's a part of me that's just like it feels almost like this awesome activity to call baseball on radio. I think the thing I like about TV is the way, see, on radio, obviously you're the eyes for the listener, right? So
right.
Doing play-by-play on radio, you have to do everything. And then there's, you know, a lot of definition to what you need to do to describe the game for the audience. Whereas on TV, you could be a little bit more creative, even though you're doing less. It's sort of a more broad canvas because you're not boxed into having to do these specific things in order to make it work, right? So, and it depends on who you work with too. Like, I work with amazing analysts, I guess. So I love the time and freedom and creativity we have to be on TV. So I'd say I prefer TV, but I truly, truly have loved the games I've gotten to call on radio.
And you were scheduled to call Yankee games in Toronto last September for WFAN, but that was when Aaron Judge was chasing Roger Maris's record, and then Sterling took some of those games back. He wasn't going to travel to Toronto with Judge looking like he could potentially tie or break the record there. He ended up going to Toronto. Did you expect Sterling to take those games back already? Like, were you kind of bracing for that to happen, looking at the schedule? Were you bothered in the slightest that you were scheduled to take to call those games and then they went back to John?
You know, I really wasn't bothered. And I'm not just saying that because it's interesting because I'm a ridiculously competitive person and there's nothing I love more than calling big moments in this business when it comes to my career. But I wasn't bothered at all. I did anticipate it. I had reached out to Chris Olivero, the boss at FAN, weeks before, and I was like, hey, I'm just seeing the way this is going.
Okay.
And I am thinking there's a chance John is going to want back on here because Judge might be around 61. And Chris was like, at the time, he was like, nope, John says he's not going to Toronto. Like, it's yours. Like, and he was like, so it's yours. And I was like, okay, you know, I would understand, but that's fine. I'm obviously thrilled to do it. And then we got like, you know, we got closer and maybe it was like 5 days before, 4 days before something. He was like, hey, I hate making this phone call, but like you were right. Like John is now. And I was like, dude, I totally understand. It's his gig. This is a huge moment. He wants to call it. He should call it. And so it wasn't really, it wasn't something that I really had huge regrets over. I wanted Judge to get it. So I was thrilled when he got 61 there. And I think he hit 61 the night of my MBA on ESPN production seminar. I'm pretty sure we were all there. So I was cool with it. I thought John should have that moment. So I was glad that he did it.
So do you at this point envision yourself eventually being the voice of a specific team calling 140, 150 games on TV or radio for one team?
No, I don't. I think that, you know, I don't ever say never for any,
yeah, of course,
any gig or whatever it might be. And like, I've tried to, there, you know, I have specific career goals, but my more broadly, I want to call big events with great teammates. That's what I want to do. Like calling the women's Final Four this past year and feeling the breath of that event and the excitement of the action, how excellent the basketball was, the intrigue around it, and then getting to do it with Rebecca Lobo, who I just absolutely adore and I think is as good as any analyst in the country, and Andrea Carter and Holly Rowe, who are both incredible at what they do, and we're all just a great unit of friendship as well. And then with an amazing producer in Kerry Callahan and an amazing director in Jimmy Platt. Like that to me, like I want to do as much of that in my career as I can. How that manifests, what specific roles or jobs that is, I think tends to unfold naturally when you just do good work and you focus on the work and then things sort of unfold from there. But that feeling of, you know, having, you know, in that case, I think our numbers peaked at 12.6 million viewers, you know, having millions upon millions of people engaged in something you care and prepare so deeply for, and doing it with people who you love and trust working with, and, you know, bring out the best in you and your work. That is really my goal. You know, is there a chance that that could manifest someday in what you said? Like, yeah, I guess there is, but I think there's a lot of other ways that can manifest as well.
Speaking of calling big moments, and this was a big moment for a very different situation, but it's crazy that it's more than 3 years ago now. But it's something that I think kind of goes down as a bit of a historic moment, and that is the fact that you were on ESPN calling the Nuggets and Mavericks March 11th, 2020, when the NBA announced that it was going to suspend its season for COVID. How was it being on the call as all of that chaos was kind of like starting to unfold?
That was one of the most surreal nights of my life. It felt like we were in a movie. And I literally remember at the time thinking, and now, of course, the further removed you get, it seems, I don't want to say silly, but it just seems like, wait, really, was it that big a deal? But I remember at the time thinking of Walter Cronkite. That's what I was thinking about. I was thinking, how would Walter Cronkite be handling this breaking news? Because it didn't feel like a basketball broadcast anymore. It felt like something obviously that was transcendent for all of us in all ways of life. And just going through that, it felt like Doris and I were doing a news broadcast, trying to provide information and comfort simultaneously, while also in some way addressing the action that was happening in front of us, that was there for the audience to see. So you couldn't totally ignore, even though it seemed inconsequential at that point, and was inconsequential at that point. And it was an eerie energy because the players almost, it seemed like, were tiptoeing around the action. And then all of a sudden got to these moments late in the game where they realized this is going to be the last basketball we play for a while. And they almost played with more gusto than at the end. So it was really strange. I am so grateful that I had Doris Burke as my partner that night, because she is and was just sensational. And I think was the perfect co-pilot to go through that night with. And then Tom Rinaldi was amazing on the sidelines for us. And we had Ian Gruca producing and Jeff Evers directing, and everybody was just, I thought, so dialed into providing the tone that was needed. So I hope I never have a broadcast like that ever again in my career, but it was a really memorable experience.
Yeah, I think, and if you look back on it, that time, those couple of days when everything started getting shut down, it's even eerie just to look back on it. And especially, like, you think, you at the time, you're sitting in an arena with 20,000 people, and I guess like the fear of COVID hadn't quite set in yet in the United States. Meanwhile, like, we saw it in other countries and we're almost like naive to the fact that it was coming here. But obviously, like, there's a comfort level, the fact that you were able to go and sit in an arena with 20,000 people, and for it to go straight from being that to the league is suspended, as opposed to, like, you know, we're not gonna eliminate crowds by 50%. We're gonna eliminate crowds completely. We're gonna not have broadcasters travel. I think it was just such a drastic measure that, like, it was almost hard to fathom at the time.
That's right. It was such a dramatic leap from anything we had ever experienced here that it was hard to fathom. And kudos to Adam Silver for being aware of what was needed at that time, because I think a lot of people would have sort of tepidly examined how to function, and he knew, like, nope, this is what needs to be done.
And then everybody
right
else
now
followed suit.
Yep, exactly. And the NBA was, in a lot of ways, a leader at that moment in our country. And I think that the NBA, in a lot of ways, continues to be a leader for a lot of us.
You've worked with Jeff Van Gundy, which we talked about. You've also called games with Mark Jackson, J.J. Redick, Richard Jefferson. Is there an analyst that you've worked with that you think is more hungry to get into coaching than any others?
That's a good question. I don't think so. You know, I think that,
like, we hear Van Gundy's name get mentioned every so often. Jackson has gone on interviews. J.J. Redick has now apparently gone on interviews as well.
Right. I think that J.J. obviously interviewed in Toronto. I think that Mark and Jeff obviously have been coaches and successful coaches in the NBA. And because of that, when you're a coach, I think that bug is always in there.
Yeah.
Like, those guys are elite broadcasters, but they're coaches. You know, that's in their soul. And so I'm sure that no matter how great the broadcasting gig is, no matter what, it's always in there. And if the right opportunity came along, I'm sure there would always be interest. That's just me surmising. That's not me commenting on how they talk about it, but just knowing that if that's what's in your soul, that's what's in your soul. And with JJ, you know, I've gotten to know JJ really well. We've worked together a lot this year. We've become good friends. He absolutely loves the NBA. JJ Redick is obsessed with the NBA, absolutely obsessed with the NBA. And I think that there is a strong part of him that feels motivated to just serve the game and the league and give to the game and the league and try and promote and grow the game and the league. And there are a lot of different ways that can happen. It can happen by broadcasting. It can happen with his podcast, Old Man and the Three. It can happen with the way he talks about the game on a show like First Take or Get Up or whatever he might do for us at Countdown on ESPN. I think he is excellent at everything he does, including calling games. I absolutely love calling games with him. And it could also manifest in coaching. Like, JJ would be an awesome head coach. I have no doubt about that. I've had multiple NBA players tell me that. But I think it just depends on, you know, whatever, you know, way he ends up feeling like he can best serve the game and his life. And so I feel like all avenues will, you know, be open for him because he's that dynamic. But I don't know if there's, you know, I don't know if there's any one of them that wants it more than the other. I just think, you know, all of those guys are super unique in that, you know, they are amazing broadcasters. And also, in the cases of Mark and Jeff, have been incredible coaches and would be again if they got that opportunity. In the case of JJ, I think would absolutely be an incredible coach if he got that opportunity. I don't think Richard's going to coach. Richard, I don't think Richard has any interest in coaching whatsoever. I think Richard is going to be a media mainstay for a very long time. And the unique part about Richard is he's really versatile on air. Mm-hmm. Like, Richard, not only can he be this memorable personality in the studio, like, go back and listen to him on our Knicks Heat game 6. The way Richard broke down the game, he was incredible. Like, he has this very dynamic personality, but he also, he can break down every aspect of the game like a coach. I just don't think he wants to deal with the players as a coach. That's why it's something he's not interested in. But he also has hosting abilities too. Like Richard loves taking it out of break. He loves doing a commercial read. Like he is a five-tool player when it comes to the media landscape. So I love working with all those dudes, and I consider them all friends. And I think that's one of the cool things about our NBA on ESPN crew is like we have a ton of talented analysts. Of course, you asked me about those few guys, but obviously Hubie is a legend and the best storyteller I've ever met in my life. And if you were to look at my saved voicemails right now, 50% of them are from Hubie Brown because it's just it honestly reminds me of my grandpa, and like the messages he leaves are so heartfelt and meaningful. And I cherish my time with him. And then Doris Burke is one of my closest friends in the business. And she is as good as any analyst in the country with the passion and the preparation and the analysis and the humor that she brings to the air. So we're loaded on the analyst front at ESPN.
Because you got into play-by-play at such a young age, you were similar ages to a lot of the players that were playing. Did you become friendly with some of the players? And is that something that makes it harder to call a game without any sort of bias?
That's a really good question. And I think, I think there's probably more of a blending now than ever before when it comes to, people who are in media and then athletes, because athletes themselves are in media, right? Like even right. In the case of me and CeCe, we host a podcast together. He was still pitching while we were hosting that podcast together. But he would tell me, he's like, you got to say what you got to say when you're on air, like doing a game. If I get shelled, you got to say, I didn't pitch well. So I don't really, I have developed, there are several athletes who I'm friendly with. There are some athletes that I am friends with. But I think you just have principles, and my principle for broadcasting is I'm always going to be honest on the air about what's happening. And if a friend can't respect that, then that friendship probably wasn't going to last anyway. So, I'm friends with Sue Bird. We're really close friends. If Sue goes 0-for-8 with 3 turnovers and I can't say on the air, it's been a really rough night for Sue Bird without her getting upset, then I don't think that friendship's real, right? Because she wouldn't be respecting what I have to do with my job, right? And Sue would never do that. Like, she totally gets it, And the same thing with a CeCe Sabathia or an Aaron Judge or a Joe Harris, anybody who I have that level of relationship with. I think they just have a respect for the profession and what you have to do. So, do I think you could get yourself in a spot where you feel uncomfortable? Yeah, I do. But I think if you're like Mike Breen taught me this when I was in college, he used to come back and speak to us at Fordham. And he also has been amazing to me in my career. But he said his rule is kind of he'll only say things that he feels comfortable saying to the person's face on air, and that's sort of where doing a play-by-play broadcast delineates from doing a talk show. And because you're just naturally more gratuitous on a talk show with, the shots you might take or the analysis you might give. And so I just kind of think when I'm talking about someone on air struggling, I just say it in a way I'd say it to their face. So if it's like, man, that was not a wise decision when they took a timeout when they shouldn't have, that's how I would say it to their face. Or, I probably shouldn't have gone fastball there. Whatever, And I think if you use that as a principle, then you can deal with anything else.
The R2C2 podcast with CeCe, that's been going on for almost 6 years now.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it to start that podcast? Was it pitched to both of you collectively?
No, it was CeCe's idea.
Okay.
Speaking of developing relationships, when I was doing what I was referring to before, the scoreboard hosting for the Yankees, CeCe had just come to the Yankees. I started in 09. He got there in 09. We naturally hit it off talking about basketball. Lakers were in the playoffs that year. we were both rooting for the Lakers and for Kobe to get that championship. It was his first without Shaq. And we just kind of bonded over that. Then as the years went on, he would always check in with me and be like, man, we got to do something together someday. He would text me when I was hosting my shows on ESPN radio, like, oh, I'm listening, bro, whatever. And then we were like, yeah, we got to do something someday. And then in 2017, he called me up in spring training, and he was like, hey, man, it's time. Let's do something. And I had just stopped hosting talk shows like a year and a half before, and I kind of committed mentally to not doing that.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't want to get sucked into the making mountains out of molehills culture that just naturally comes when you host a daily sports show.
Right.
It just does. Like, nobody is immune to it. As hard as you try, if you do a daily show, because you have to generate content and interest and engagement, like, you're going to make things into a bigger deal than they are. You just are.
Sure.
Take a look at the judge glancing thing, which was absolute. I mean, I had to shut off the radio yesterday because I was just like, this is the dumbest conversation I've ever heard in my life. If we're saying, like, okay, if he was getting location, there's nothing wrong with it, but let's, like, spend hours debating whether or not he was getting locations.
Yeah.
It's stupid, in my opinion. But so anyway, you're doing that over and over and over and over again. And I was just like, I'm done with that. And so I was just like, hey, if we're going to do a podcast, like, I really want it to be about storytelling and getting to know guys' personalities and no gotcha culture or whatever. And he was like, cuz, what do you think I want? Like, that's exactly what I want. And so we were very much aligned in our vision for how we wanted the podcast to go. And that's why we thought Players Tribune was the perfect place for us, because they were very much about getting athletes' messages out as well. Now, we eventually moved to several homes in the aftermath of that, and are independent at the moment. But that was kind of like CC's and my, we had a natural chemistry, a genuine relationship, a love of sports, a love of Star Wars, a love of Harry Potter, and an interest in getting to know guys better and getting guys to show their personalities more, kind of using baseball as the, you know, biggest linchpin and building out from there. And that was kind of the genesis of it. But it started with CC calling me up and saying, let's do this.
Who owns the podcast? You do own it?
Yep.
Did you have much interaction with Bill Simmons when it was at the Ringer?
I did. Yeah. I had a lot of interaction with Bill Simmons, and I still keep in touch with Bill now, and he is brilliant. Bill is, like, he is just, you can see why he's as successful as he is, because he has an amazing ear. He's incredibly involved there, gave very detailed feedback. And I'm very grateful for the conversations we had, and that we still have a relationship now where we're able to text about NBA. If he hears me calling a game, you know, whatever it might be, Yankees, Red Sox. So yeah, really grateful for developing a relationship with him.
Yeah, because I know there were some reports that it didn't end very well. That, like, CC had issues with Bill Simmons, and I don't know if it was content freedom or coaching or what. But I guess if you still have a relationship, obviously it couldn't have been that bad of a divorce.
Yeah, I don't think it was, like, from my perspective, you know, and let's see. Speak for himself, but from my perspective, I didn't think it was a bad breakup at all. I think there was, you know, I think for the Ringer and how they want the podcast done, they want 2 to 3, you know, recordings a week. They want, you know, reactions very much to, you know, live sporting events and keeping things current and less guest focused. And for CC and me, our schedules don't really necessitate 3 recordings a week schedule,
right,
or 2 recordings a week of reacting to games live, or, you know, we do that every once in a while for big games, but, like, we're much more interested in, you know, once a week evergreen conversations with guests. And so I think that had more to do with it than anything relationship wise, with why things, you know, ended as they did. I think we just sort of both sides realized it probably wasn't a fit with you know, our show the way we want to do it and even can do it, and then the way the Ringer believes in building a podcast, which obviously they've been very successful in doing. So I have no issues with their philosophy whatsoever.
So you're an independent podcast host and an ESPN employee. Are you surprised to see Pat McAfee's podcast moving to ESPN? Because some people are McAfee fans, at least, are in like panic mode over the move that he just gave up his content freedom by going to ESPN.
I don't think that you give up your content freedom at ESPN. I don't. Like, I understand why people would feel that way, but like, do we feel like Stephen A. Smith is being told what to say?
No. Yeah, for sure.
No, he's not, you know? And so, I think that, like, you know, people worried about that with Joe Rogan when he went to Spotify. You know, does anybody have that concern anymore there? I don't think they do. I think that when you're a truly dynamic personality and you have a massive following, you have like when people then sign up for you, they know what they're getting, you know,
right.
Like you. They know exactly what they're getting, and that's why they're attracted to it. So I haven't seen the hoopla about it because, like, I've been basically off of Twitter for, 5 months now. So I've kind of missed the pulse of some of the reaction to this stuff. But knowing Pat McAfee's content, like, and how incredible he is at what he does, I have no doubt that he will continue to be able to do what he wants to do. And that's why ESPN brought him in. So that's not something I'd be worried about.
How was working with Stephen A. Smith on your local radio show for a couple of years?
Amazing. Amazing. I love Stephen A. He's still a big brother to me to this day. We'll always remain close. He's always there for me if I need him. And I always will be for him as well. He's just, I think the thing that, you know, there's a lot of things that stood out to me, about working with him, his insistence on mayo being on both sides of the bread on his turkey sandwiches, but also the fact that he is just such a smart businessman. He's brilliant. He's an incredibly intelligent human being. And I loved getting to observe the way he would see things many moves ahead, business-wise, and then how easy he was to work with. You know, people might think because he has this very aggressive style of being on air that he could be difficult to work with, and he's not. He is so easy to work with. He's a great teammate. And so I'm super grateful for the experience I had with him and the fact that we still have the relationship that we do.
And that was right at the start of his kind of rebirth at ESPN. Like, I think he was named a permanent co-host on First Take right around the same time that you guys started doing the radio show together. Could you have foreseen that the larger than life personality that he was about to become?
Yeah, definitely. Because I had seen it the first time through, and then witnessing him up close, and he has a really unique way with words, and words stick. Like, part of this business is making phrases, making words stick. He does it with a verve and a passion and an intelligence that just, it sticks. Like, when you're watching him, you're just like, this guy's memorable. You know,
yeah.
He's just like, he's really good at what he does. And so working with him up close, like, I absolutely saw that up close. So I totally could see it coming. It's funny because the way we got paired together is they wanted to move Stephen A. into this time slot. And I had a clause in my contract that didn't allow them to move me. And so they just kind of like they first were talking to me about, I don't know if I really ever told this story, but they were talking to me about like, hey, would you want to go to this time slot at night? And I'm like, no, I broadcast games. I can't do that. And then that made them sort of be like, okay. Like, and they were, you know, at the time believers in my hosting abilities too. And that made them kind of think like, okay, well, could we have Steven with Ryan? And we met, and Steven showed me incredible respect from jump. And Steven had a lot to do with me starting to do play-by-play at ESPN. You know, we were doing a radio show first, and he was one of the people who said to the bosses at ESPN internally, like, hey, have you heard Ryan do Nets games? Why is he not doing play-by-play for us at ESPN? And so I'm always grateful to him for that. But I don't think – I think if they would have had it their way, Steven would have just been a solo host, like, right away on the radio show. But they were kind of stuck with me, and then they decided, all right, let's try and make the most out of it. And it's funny, too. I think about it now. Like, I was really bold. I was like, they wanted to do, like, Stephen A. with Ryan Rucco, and I was like, nope. I was like, I'm the co-host. It's going to say and it's funny now, because like at this moment in time, and even then, like, there's nothing insulting about that. This is Stephen A. Smith, you know.
Yeah.
But I was just kind of like, hey, this is like what my contract says. Like, we're abiding by it. And it ended up a great thing, not because our show had some long run together, but because it allowed me to develop this relationship with Steven, which has been an incredibly fruitful one for my career, but more importantly, a really meaningful one for my life.
Was that relationship at all like, did it struggle at the start because it was a bit of a forced marriage? Like, did he
I don't think
trust
so.
You from the start? And
yeah, he did. He trusted me from the start. He was amazing to me from the start. The only thing that was difficult was the fact that we were rarely in the same location.
Yeah.
So that part of it was hard. And at that point there wasn't like this kind of thing, right? Where you could look at each other and
right. It
doesn't feel like it's really missing a beat. So that was hard, because it was hard to know, like, when is Stephen A. done talking? When do I start? Whatever. And then when we'd be in person doing shows, I'd be like, oh my gosh, these shows are so good. But that was the only hard part, was being in two different locations. But really from jump, he treated me like his brother. And to this day, we have a big brother, little brother relationship, where like, I know he always has my back, and he probably would need me less than I need him, but I would always have his back too.
What's amazing to me about Stephen A. Smith is just his lack of complacency. Like in the last 11 or 12 years or so, he went from returning to ESPN in a bit of a small role to becoming the face of ESPN. And now at 55 years old and as the face of ESPN, he still seems like he's starving for more. Like he's talking politics now. He's floating the idea of running for office. He wants to take over for Jimmy Kimmel. He wants to act. He wants to produce content. And regardless of whether you're a fan of Stephen A. Smith or not, like, everybody has to respect that desire to never settle, to never get complacent.
Yeah, his work ethic is second to none, and I would never bet against Stephen A. Smith. Whatever he wants to do, he is capable of pulling off. Of that, I am 100% sure.
So, speaking of that lack of complacency, I guess, like, what are your career aspirations? Is it to be ESPN's lead NBA voice? To do more national games in another sport? Is it something with the NFL maybe? Or and like, understanding that these jobs are filled, but in the same way that Stephen A. Smith would eventually like to take over for Jimmy Kimmel, what job are you chasing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting because the jobs are occupied, you know, you're always hesitant to say any one specific thing, because
It's like,
oh, okay, people think like, oh, you're gunning for it, you know? And it's like, well, no, I'm saying that like someday down the road, this is a goal when the timing's right, you know? And so the NBA finals are absolutely that for me. But Mike Breen should do the NBA finals for as long as Mike Breen wants to do the NBA finals. And then there are a million other great, you know, people out there, as well. So like, someday, is that a career goal? If the timing was right and the opportunity was there and it was you know, the right time for it, absolutely, yes. But more so than that, because you just never know the way things are going to go, and there's a lot of it that's out of your control. My more central focus is, like, I want to continue crushing whatever opportunities I get. I want to get to work with amazing teammates who bring out the best in me doing big events. And if that ends up the NBA Finals someday, awesome. If that ends up something I haven't even thought of, awesome. You know, I already get to call a couple of amazing, huge events and championships. And I'm fortunate to do those and would love to continue to do them. And then where it goes from there is, you know, usually just sort of naturally unfolds. But I feel, you know, my other career goal is I want to be in a Pro Sports Hall of Fame someday. That's been a goal since I was 21 years old. And so I feel like, you know, the ways you get there is not by worrying about it or, you know, trying to manipulate your way to any particular goal. It's you put your head down, you be a good teammate, you do great work, and then things usually unfold as they should. And if that's something you had in mind, great. And if it's not, it's because something better was meant for you. And that's kind of my general philosophy I try and take, as fun as it is to entertain specific goals in this business.
Ryan, you were great. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, I appreciate you having me, Brandon. Thanks for your thoughtful questions, man.
Of course. That's Ryan Rucco. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.